Tanglefoot Productions, in association with Sun Sounds of Arizona, presents Jules Verne's From the Earth to the Moon, based on the novels From the Earth to the Moon and Round the Moon by Jules Verne, adapted for radio and directed by M.V. Moorhead, produced by Roy Weinberg.
During the War of the Rebellion, a new and influential club was established in the city of Baltimore, in the state of Maryland. It is well known with what energy the taste for military matters became developed in America. The cannon, howitzers, and mortars of the English, French, and Prussians are mere pocket pistols compared with the formidable engines of the American artillery. Now, when an American has an idea, he directly seeks a second American to share it. If there be three, they elect a president and two secretaries. So things were managed in Baltimore. The inventor of a new cannon associated himself with the caster and the borer. Thus was formed the nucleus of the Gun Club. In a single month after its formation, it numbered 1,833 effective members and 30,565 corresponding members. The Gun Club, once founded, it is easy to conceive the result of the inventive genius of the Americans. Their military weapons attained colossal proportions, and their projectiles, exceeding the prescribed limits, unfortunately, occasionally cut into some unoffending pedestrians. One day, however, one sad and melancholy day in 1865, peace was declared between the survivors of the war. The thunder of the guns gradually ceased, and the Gun Club was relegated to profound inactivity by this disastrous peace. Until the evening of October 3rd, when the Gun Club's president, Impey Barbicane, requested that the membership gather at 8 p.m. for what he called a communication of an extremely interesting nature.
"This is horrible. Nothing to do. Nothing to look forward to. What a loathsome existence, Mr. Bilsby. When again shall the guns arouse us in the morning with their delightful reports?"
"Those days are gone by, Mr. Hunter. It was delightful once upon a time. One invented a gun, and hardly was it cast, when one hastened to try it in the face of the enemy. But now the generals are gone back to their counters, and in place of projectiles, they dispatch bales of cotton. By Jove, the future of gunnery in America is lost."
"Aye, and no war in prospect. Not a cloud on the horizon, and that, too, at such a critical period in the progress of the science of artillery. I have given both a right arm and a left leg to the service, not only of the great Union, but also to the noble art of gunnery. And all at once, the New World seems to have made up its mind to live in peace. Shall the air never again be lighted with the glare of our guns? Will no international difficulty ever arise to enable us to declare war against some transatlantic power? Shall not the French sink one of our steamers, or the English, in defiance of the rights of nations, hang a few of our countrymen?"
"No such luck. In this state of affairs, gentlemen, I cannot conceive what President Barbicane can have in mind convening this meeting."
"We shall know soon enough, sir. Here he comes."
"Punctual as a chronometer, as always."
"Barbicane." "Thank you all for coming. My brave colleagues, too long already a paralyzing peace has plunged the members of the Gun Club in deplorable inactivity. After a period of years full of combat, we have been compelled to abandon our labors and to stop short on the road of progress. I do not hesitate to state baldly that any war which would recall us to arms would be welcome." "But war, gentlemen, is impossible under existing circumstances, and however we may desire it, many years may elapse before our cannons shall again thunder in the field of battle. We must make up our minds, then, to seek, in another train of ideas, some field for the activity which we all pine for. For some months past, my brave colleagues, I have been asking myself whether we could not enter upon some grand experiment worthy of the 19th century, and whether the progress of artillery science would not enable us to carry it out to a successful issue. I have been considering, working, calculating, and the result of my studies is the conviction that we are safe to succeed in an enterprise which to any other country would appear wholly impracticable. This project, the result of long elaboration, is the subject of my present communication. It is worthy of yourselves, worthy of the antecedents of the Gun Club, and it cannot fail to make some noise in the world. There is no one among you, my brave colleagues, who has not seen the moon, or at least heard speak of it. Don't be surprised if I am about to discourse to you regarding the Queen of the Night. It is perhaps reserved for us to become the Columbuses of this unknown world. Only enter into my plans and second me with all your power, and I will lead you to its conquest, and its name shall be added to those of the 36 states which compose this great union.
Three cheers for the moon!
Hurrah for the moon!
The moon!
The moon!
The moon! The moon, gentlemen, has been carefully studied. All is known regarding the moon, which mathematical science, astronomy, geology, and optics can learn about her. But up to the present moment, no direct communication has been established with her. It is reserved for the practical genius of Americans to establish a communication with the sidereal world. The means of arriving thither are simple, easy, certain, infallible, and that is the purpose of my present proposal. You all know what progress artillery science has made during the last few years. I ask myself whether it might not be possible to project a shot up to the moon. Gentlemen, suffer me to finish, gentlemen. I have looked at the question in all its bearings, I have resolutely attacked it, and by incontrovertible calculations, I find that a projectile endowed with an initial velocity of 12,000 yards per second aimed at the moon must necessarily reach it. I have the honor, my brave colleagues, to propose a trial of this little experiment.
Nothing can astound an American. In America, all is easy, all is simple, and as for mechanical difficulties, they are overcome before they arise. Between Barbicane's proposition and its realization, no true Yankee would have allowed even the semblance of a difficulty to be possible. A thing with them is no sooner said than done. Thus, within a week of President Barbicane's proposal, 500 newspapers and journals all took up the question. All the journals published by the scientific, literary, and religious societies enlarged upon its advantages. Impe Barbicane was proclaimed one of the greatest citizens of the United States, a kind of Washington of science, and the Society of Natural History of Boston, the Society of Science and Art of Albany, the Geographical and Statistical Society of New York, the Philosophical Society of Philadelphia, and the Smithsonian of Washington sent letters of congratulation to the Gun Club, together with offers of immediate assistance and money. Soon, President Barbicane had, without loss of time, nominated a working committee of the Gun Club. The duty of this committee was to resolve the three grand questions of the cannon, the projectile, and the powder. It was composed of four members of great technical knowledge: Barbicane, with a casting vote in case of equality, Mr. Hunter, Mr. Bilsby, and J.T. Maston, to whom were confided the functions of secretary. On the 8th of October, the committee met at the house of President Barbicane. The meeting was opened by the president himself.
Gentlemen, we have to resolve one of the most important problems in the whole of the noble science of gunnery. It might appear perhaps the most logical course is to devote our first meeting to the discussion of the engine to be employed. Nevertheless, after mature consideration, it has appeared to me that the question of the projectile must take precedence over that of the cannon, and that the dimensions of the latter must necessarily depend on those of the former.
Suffer me to say a word, Mr. Barbicane.
Proceed, Mr. Maston.
Gentlemen, our president is right. in placing the question of the projectile above all others. The ball we are about to discharge at the moon is our ambassador to her, and I wish to consider it from a moral point of view. The cannonball, gentlemen, to my mind, is the most magnificent manifestation of human power. Without any regret did I give up two of my limbs in the service of its development. If Providence has created the stars and the planets, man has called the cannonball into existence. Let Providence claim the swiftness of electricity and of light. We claim to have invented the swiftness of the cannonball, 100 times superior to that of the swiftest horses or railway train. How glorious will be the moment when, infinitely exceeding all hitherto attained velocities, we shall launch our new projectile with the rapidity of 7 miles a second. Shall it not, gentlemen, shall it not be received up there with the honors due to a terrestrial ambassador?
Quite. And now let us quit the domain of poetry and come direct to the question.
By all means.
The problem before us is how to communicate to a projectile a velocity of 12,000 yards per second. Let us at present examine the velocities hitherto attained. Mr. Hunter will be able to enlighten us on this point.
And the more easily that during the war, I was a member of the Committee of Experiments. I may say, then, that Rodman Columbiad threw a shot weighing 0.5 ton, a distance of 6 miles, with a velocity of 800 yards per second.
This is, I believe, the maximum velocity ever attained.
It is so.
Oh, if my mortar had not burst.
Yes, but it did burst. We must take then for our starting point this velocity of 800 yards. We must increase it 20-fold. That is why I propose to construct a gun of 900 feet.
But what thickness must we give it?
A thickness of 6 feet, Mr. Bilsby.
You surely don't think of mounting a mass like that upon a carriage.
Impracticable. No, I think that sinking this engine in the earth alone, binding it with hoops of wrought iron, and finally surrounding it with a thick mass of masonry of stone and cement. We must now take into consideration the metal to be employed. Our cannon must be possessed of great tenacity, great hardness, and be infusible by heat and indissoluble.
Well, then, I propose the best alloy hitherto known, which consists of 100 parts of copper, 12 of tin, and 6 of brass.
I admit, Mr. Hunter, that this composition has yielded excellent results, but in this present case it would be too expensive, and very difficult indeed to work. I think, then, that we ought to adopt a material excellent in its way and of low price, such as cast iron.
Cast iron is very brittle.
Yes, but it possesses great resistance. And I will now ask for our worthy Mr. Maston to calculate the weight of a 900-foot-long cast iron gun with a bore of 9 feet and a thickness of 6 feet.
In a moment. The cannon will weigh 68,040 tons, and at 2 cents a pound it will cost 2,510,701.
Make yourselves easy, gentlemen. The money will not be wanting.
It seemed likely that President Barbicane was right, for legions of admirers and friends rallied round his project. There was, however, one single individual alone in all the states of the Union who protested against the efforts of the Gun Club. He attacked it furiously in the press at every opportunity, and human nature is such that Barbicane felt more keenly the opposition of that one man than he did the applause of all the others. He was well aware of the motive of this antipathy, the origin of this solitary enmity, the cause of its personality and old standing, and in what rivalry of self-love it had its rise. This persevering enemy, the president of the Gun Club had never seen. Fortunate that it was so, for a meeting between the two men would certainly have been attended with serious consequences. This rival was a man of science, like Barbicane himself, of a fiery, daring, and violent disposition, a pure Yankee. His name was Captain Nickel. He lived at Philadelphia. Most people are aware of the curious struggle which arose during the war between the states, between the makers of guns and makers of armor for iron-plated ships like the Merrimack, the Monitor, the Tennessee, and the Weehawken. Now, if Barbicane was a great founder of shot, Nickel was a great forger of plates. The one cast night and day at Baltimore, the other forged day and night at Philadelphia. As soon as ever Barbicane invented a new shot, Nickel invented a new plate. But one day, when Barbicane substituted for conical shot simple 600-pound shells, at very moderate velocity, these projectiles knocked Nickel's best metal plate to bits. Victory seemed to rest with the shot, as the war came to an end on the very day when Nickel had completed a new armor plate of wrought steel, a masterpiece of its kind, bidding defiance to all the projectiles of the world. He challenged the president of the gun club to break it. Barbicane, peace having been declared, declined to try the experiment.
Barbicane, here's another letter from Captain Nickel chiding you for your obstinacy and offering to place his armor plate a mere 100 feet from your gun.
Not even at 75 feet. The war is over.
He also writes that he's willing to stand behind the plate while you fire at it.
Kindly reply to Captain Nickel that I won't fire at his plate, even if he would be so good as to stand in front of it.
One question remained yet to be decided. It was necessary to choose a favorable spot for the experiment. On the 20th of October, at a meeting of the Gun Club, Barbicane produced a magnificent map of the United States.
Gentlemen, I presume that we are all agreed that this experiment cannot and ought not to be tried anywhere but within the limits of the soil of the Union.
Right.
But according to the advice of our friends at the Observatory of Cambridge, the gun must be fired perpendicularly to the plane of the horizon, that is to say, toward the zenith. Now, the moon does not traverse the zenith except in places situated between 0 degrees and 28 degrees. Now, by good fortune, certain frontiers of the United States extend downward as far as the 28th parallel of the north latitude. If you will cast your eye over this map, you will see we have at our disposal the whole of the southern portions of Texas and Florida.
It was thus agreed that the Columbiad must be cast on the soil of either Texas or Florida. The result, however, of this decision was to create a rivalry entirely without precedent between these two states. If seven cities of Greece contended for the honor of having given birth to a Homer, here were two entire states threatening to come to blows about the question of a cannon.
The enterprise being essentially American, doesn't it seem that it ought not to be attempted upon other than purely American territory?
American? Are we not as American as you? Were not Texas and Florida both incorporated into the Union in 1845?
Undoubtedly. But we have belonged to the Americans ever since 1820.
Yes. After being Spaniards or English for 200 years, you were sold to the United States for $5 million.
Why need we blush for that? Was not Louisiana bought from Napoleon in 1803 at the price of $16 million?
Scandalous! A wretched little strip of country like Florida dares compare itself to Texas, who, in place of selling herself, asserted her own independence, drove out the Mexicans in March of 1846, and declared herself a federal republic after the victory gained by Samuel Houston over the troops of Santa Anna. A country, in short, which voluntarily annexed itself to the United States of America.
Yes, because you were afraid of the Mexicans.
Afraid? Why, you swamp log!
And so on. A sanguinary encounter seemed imminent between the two states when President Barbicane resolved to get rid of it all at once.
Upon consideration of what is going on now between Florida and Texas, I believe it is clear that the same difficulties will recur with all the towns of the favored state. The rivalry will descend from state to city and so on downward. Now, Texas possesses 11 towns within our prescribed conditions, which will further dispute the honor and create us new enemies, while Florida has only one. I go in, therefore, for Florida and Tampa Town.
This decision, on being made known, utterly crushed the Texans. They could only hurl one last and bitter sarcasm at their adversaries.
How unfortunate. Florida, a mere peninsula confined between two seas, will never sustain the shock of the discharge. It will surely bust up at the very first shot.
To which Florida replied with Spartan brevity.
Very well. Let it bust up.
The astronomical, mechanical, and topographical difficulties resolved, finally came the question of finance. The sum required was far too great for any individual, or even any single state, to provide the requisite millions. President Barbicane undertook, despite of the matter being a purely American affair, to render it one of universal interest, and to request the financial cooperation of all peoples.
It is, I maintain, the right and duty of the whole earth to interfere in the affairs of its satellite.
Therefore, the subscription opened at Baltimore extended properly to the whole world, and was successful beyond all expectation, notwithstanding that it was a question not of lending, but of giving the money. It was a purely disinterested operation in the strictest sense of the term, and offered not the slightest chance of profit. Thus, the transport of workmen, their establishment in an almost uninhabited country, the construction of furnaces and workshops, the plant, the powder, and the projectile, the work of casting, boring, and masonry began at once near Tampa Town, and was nearly completed by the end of September of the following year. The discharge of the Columbiad was therefore planned for December 1st. But on September 30th, a telegram arrived from Paris at the residence of President Barbicane, which read as follows.
France, Paris, 30 September, 4 a.m., to Barbicane, Tampa Town, Florida, United States. Substitute for your spherical shell a cylindrical conical projectile. I shall go inside. Shall arrive by steamer Atlanta. Michel Ardan.
A few weeks after the arrival of this astounding communique, President Barbicane, J.T. Maston, and the other leaders of the Gun Club eagerly awaited the arrival of its author at Tampa Town.
Is this journalist mentioned in the telegram under the name of Michel Ardan on his way here, yes or no?
Gentlemen, I know no more than you do, only that he is due to arrive today.
We must know.
Time will show.
Time has no business keeping us in suspense this way.
Mr. Maston, I pray you don't overexcite yourself. This telegram might be a cover for some jest, especially as it came from a Frenchman.
Indeed, what human being would ever have conceived the idea of such a journey? And if such a person really existed, must he not be an imbecile whom one would shut up in a lunatic ward rather than within the walls of our projectile? The whole thing's preposterous, I tell you.
It's a grand idea all the same.
Excuse me, gentlemen, but we have a visitor. Come in, sir, please.
You are Barbicane, I suppose.
I am.
Superb. I am Michel Ardan.
Welcome. These are my colleagues at the Gun Club, Mr. Hunter, Mr. Bilsby, and Mr. J.T. Maston.
Last. You are a hero, young man. A hero.
So, you are quite determined to go?
Quite decided.
Nothing will stop you?
Nothing. Have you modified your projectile according to my telegram?
We waited for your arrival, but have you carefully reflected?
Reflected? Have I any time to spare? I find an opportunity of making a tour of the moon, and I mean to profit by it. There is the whole gist of the matter.
A hero, I say. We are only like weak, silly women compared with this European.
Not at all, monsieur. It seems to me a matter quite simple, natural, and easy to take one's place in a projectile and start for the moon. The journey must be undertaken sooner or later, and as for the mode of locomotion adopted, it is simply the law of progress. Man began by walking on all fours, then one fine day on 2 feet, then in a carriage, then in a stagecoach, and lastly by railway. Now, The projectile is the vehicle of the future. Yes, in spite of the opinions of certain narrow-minded people who would shut up the human race upon this globe, we shall one day travel to the moon, the planets, and the stars with the same facility, rapidity, and certainty as we make the voyage from Liverpool to New York. Distance is but a relative expression and must end by being reduced to zero. Distance is but an empty name. Distance does not really exist.
Hurrah! Distance does not exist!
Madness! Pure fancies!
Another visitor?
It would so appear. Please come in, sir.
Madness, you say? How so, monsieur?
You are, I believe, the rash young Frenchman who proposes to go inside the projectile to the moon?
I am he, good sir. But how can you call me rash? Have I not demanded a cylindro, conical projectile in order to prevent turning round and round on my way like a squirrel?
But, unhappy man, the dreadful recoil will smash you to pieces at your starting.
My dear sir, you have just put your finger upon the true and only difficulty. Nevertheless, I have too good an opinion of the industrial genius of our Americans not to believe they will succeed in overcoming it.
You're a hopeless fool. You will inevitably kill yourself, and your death will be that of a madman, useless even to science. And it will be the responsibility of another.
Who, may I ask?
The ignoramus who organizes equally absurd and impossible experiment, Impe Barbicane.
Sir, would you be good enough to tell us your name?
My name is Nickel.
So I suspected. Hitherto, chance has never thrown you in my way.
I am come to Tampa Town precisely for that purpose. You have determined to fire a cannon shot at the moon, yet you have refused upon challenge to fire one at my armor plating, at all but point-blank range. I am therefore obliged to speculate about cowardice, in keeping with my long-held belief that artillerists who fight at 6 miles distance are substituting mathematical formulae for individual courage.
The impertinence!
Outrageous!
Gentlemen, excuse me, please, but will you allow me the honor of a few words alone with Captain Nickel?
Very well. Let us go, gentlemen.
Yes, come, my friends. Take me where I may secure some lunch.
President Barbicane?
Please see to our young guest, Mr. Maston. I will join you later.
Very well.
You have insulted me, Captain.
Publicly.
And you will answer to me for this insult?
At this very moment.
No. This is not a fitting spot. I think all that passes between us should be secret. But there is a woodland situated just outside Tampa, the Wood of Scarcenaugh. Do you know it?
I can find it.
Will you be so good as to enter it tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock on one side?
Yes, if you will enter at the other side at the same hour.
And you will not forget your pistol?
No more than you will forget yours.
Well, tomorrow morning, then.
But at 4 o'clock the following morning, at the lodgings of Michel Ardan.
Qu'est-ce que c'est? Who is it?
J.T. Maston, Mr. Ardan.
Maston?
Open up, young man, please.
My new friend Maston. To what do I owe the honor of a visit at this hour?
Listen to me. Yesterday you saw this man Nickel insult President Barbicane.
Insult? Nothing that Barbicane need take seriously, I am sure.
He is taking it seriously, sir. I assure you, Barbicane slipped this note under the door of my lodgings earlier. He thought I would not read it until the affair was over. He and Nickel are to meet this morning in the Wood of Scarcenaugh with pistols. If Barbicane is killed, our moon scheme is at an end. We must prevent this duel. And just now, one man alone has enough influence over Barbicane to stop him. And that man is you, Michel Ardan.
I think not.
Don't think. Just get dressed and bring a lantern if you have one. We must make haste.
Just an hour later, Ardan and Maston found themselves in a dense thicket in which rose huge cypresses, sycamores, tulip trees, olives, tamarinds, oaks, and magnolias, their branches interwoven into an inextricable maze.
last my wooden leg. It slows me down in this swampy terrain. Oh, what does it matter? It's 5 o'clock now. It must all be over. A man like Barbicane would not dodge with his enemy or ensnare him. He would not even maneuver. He is too open, too brave. He has gone straight ahead, right into the danger.
But surely, since we entered the wood, we would have heard the shots. Wait, look, up there ahead. Do you see the light of a lantern?
Yes, Barbicane, President Barbicane.
Slow down, friend Maston. Remember, they are armed. We must approach cautiously.
Can you see?
Yes. It's Captain Nicholl. His pistol is on the ground next to him.
Ah, he fears no adversary. We are too late.
He's shining his lantern on. It looks like a great spider web. Let us go to him and find out the truth.
Captain Nicholl?
Michel Ardan, Mr. Maston.
What are you doing here?
I'm trying to help this poor little bird. He's become caught in the web of one of these infernal Florida spiders as big as a pigeon egg. And I'm trying to set the poor fellow free before his host returns for his breakfast.
I have a penknife, Captain. Will you allow me to assist you?
With gratitude.
There. There he goes, safe and sound.
I am obliged to you, but why are you here?
To press your hand, Nicholl. And to prevent you from either killing Barbicane or being killed by him.
Barbicane? That's right. I have been looking for him in vain. Where is he hiding?
Hiding? This is not courteous.
Indeed it is not. For look, gentlemen, there is Monsieur le President over there sitting under that catalpa tree.
It is he. Mr. Barbicane.
Barbicane, Monsieur Barbicane, can you hear us?
Like he's in a trance, writing in that notebook.
A last will and testament, perhaps.
Mr. Barbicane, awake, sir.
Mr. Ardan, it is you. How curious that you're here, but I have found it, my friend, I have found it.
Found what?
My plan.
What plan?
The plan for countering the effect of the shock of the departure of the projectile.
Indeed?
Yes, it's simply water. A layer of water under the deck which will act as a cushion and... Oh, Maston, you're here also?
I am.
And permit me to introduce you at the same time, the worthy Captain Nicholl.
Nicholl, pardon me, Captain, I had quite forgotten. I have my weapon here somewhere, I'm ready.
Nonsense. Michel Ardan tells you this. There will be no duel between you. You came out here to duel, and I find one of you trying to rescue a bird from a spider, and the other working on the calculations to keep me alive. Are two such good fellows as you really going to blow each other's skulls open with that shot?
Between President Barbicane and myself, young man, there is rivalry to the death of one of us.
Pooh! You shall not fight.
I will fight, sir.
Captain Nicholl, I am a friend of the President's, his alter ego, his second self. If you really must kill someone, shoot me. I will do just as well.
Sir, these jokes...
Our friend Maston is not joking. I fully understand his idea of being killed himself to save his friend. But neither he nor Barbicane will fall before the bulls of Captain Nicholl. Indeed, I have so attractive a proposal to make to the two rivals that both will be eager to accept it.
And what is that?
Monsieur le President, you believe your projectile will go straight to the moon?
Yes, certainly.
And our friend Nicholl is persuaded it will fall back upon the earth?
I am certain of it.
Good. I cannot pretend to make you agree, but I suggest this. Go with me. And so see whether we are stopped on our journey. Well?
Done.
Done.
Hurrah. Hip, hip, hurrah.
Yes, bravo.
But, Mr. President, since you and the captain have determined to go along with young Ardan, you must permit me to join you and make a party of four.
Certainly not.
Yes, I'm afraid this cannot be, my good Maston.
And why not?
Well, you see, my friend, and you must not take what I say in a bad way, but... Really, you are in too incomplete a condition to appear on the moon.
Incomplete?
Yes, my dear fellow. Suppose we should succeed in landing on the moon. Imagine our meeting some of the inhabitants up there, and you, missing a leg, with a hook where your right arm should be. Would you like to give them such a melancholy notion of what goes on down here? To teach them what war is, to inform them that we employ our time chiefly in destroying each other, in smashing arms and legs, all on a bountiful globe which is capable of supporting billions of inhabitants, why, my worthy friend, we should have to keep you out of sight.
He's right, you know.
The point is academic in any case. It pains me to refuse you, my dear Maston, but you must understand that the projectile as designed, according to your own unassailable calculations, could not possibly contain so many passengers.
Oh, very well. I withdraw my request.
Wisely spoken, sir.
For this trip, at least.
Bravo again. And now that all is settled, my dear friends, allow me to treat you after the French fashion. Let us be off to breakfast.
On the completion of the Columbiad gun, attention now turned to the projectile itself, the vehicle which was destined to carry the three hardy adventurers into space. The new plans were sent to Breadwill and Company of Albany, with the request for their speedy execution. The projectile was consequently cast on the 2nd of November and immediately forwarded by the Eastern Railway to Tampa Town, which it reached without accident on the 10th of that month, and where Michel Ardan, Barbicane, and Nickel were waiting impatiently for it.
You see, gentlemen, this watertight wooden disc which forms the floor of our chamber sits upon a bed of water to the depth of 3 feet. Upon firing, this water will be expelled as the disc collapses upon it and will sufficiently mitigate the shock of our departure.
Admirable.
Absurd. The gun will never be successfully loaded. The gun cotton will ignite while it is being packed. And even if by some miracle that does not happen, we will be blown to bits upon firing, and even if we are not, we will never reach the moon. But at least you have elegantly appointed our death chamber and given us plenty of windows so that we will have a fine view of our doom.
Would you care to make a bet on those three claims, Captain?
By all means, Mr. Barbicane.
$3,000, $4,000, and $5,000 acceptable sums, respectively.
Most assuredly, though I greatly doubt that either of us will survive either to pay or to collect them.
You shall certainly survive, Captain, and more happily still, you shall certainly lose all three of your bets.
The 1st of December had arrived, the fateful day. For, if the projectile were not discharged that very night at 10:48 p.m., more than 18 years must roll by before the moon would again present herself under the same conditions of zenith and perigee. After dawn, an innumerable multitude covered the area around the sunken barrel of the Columbiad. For a whole month previously, the mass of these persons had bivouacked around the enclosure. According to the statement of the Tampa Town Observer, not less than 5 million spectators thronged the soil of Florida. About 7 o'clock in the evening, on December 1st, the moon rose above the horizon. Millions of hurrahs hailed her appearance. At 10 o'clock, the Frenchman and the two Americans entered the enclosure in the projectile.
My dear Maston, I have regulated my chronometer to the 10th part of a second with yours, and I charge you with the duty of firing the Columbiad by means of an electric spark. In this way, we will be able to follow with our own eyes the precise moment of our departure.
Our departure for the next world, he means.
It will be done with all exactitude, fear not. The moment has arrived for saying goodbye, President Barbicane.
A touching scene. Observe, Captain Nickel, how our friend Maston has found, in his own dry eyes, one ancient tear.
Doubtless he reserved it for the occasion.
Can I not go along? You are quite sure.
Impossible, sir. You are needed here.
Very well. Godspeed, Barbicane. Godspeed, all of you.
The three fellow travelers then ensconced themselves in the projectile and screwed down the plate which covered the entrance aperture. The moon advanced upward in a heaven of the purest clearness, outshining in her passage the twinkling light of the stars. A terrible silence weighed upon the entire scene. Not a breath of wind upon the earth. Not a sound of breathing from the countless chests of the spectators. Their hearts seemed afraid to beat. All eyes were fixed upon the yawning mouth of the Columbiad. Maston followed with his eye the hand of his chronometer. It wanted scarce 40 seconds to the moment of departure, but each second seemed to last an age.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Fire!
Instantly, Maston pressed, with his hook, the key of the electric battery and discharged the spark into the breech of the Columbiad. Florida was shaken to its very depths, though it did not, as Texas had predicted, bust up. An immense spout of fire shot up from the bowels of the earth as from a crater. The earth heaved up, and with great difficulty, some few spectators obtained a momentary glimpse of the projectile victoriously cleaving the air in the midst of the fiery vapors. After this, however, the projectile was no longer to be seen, and the public and the leaders of the gun club alike were obliged to wait for telegrams from the director of the Cambridge Observatory. A few days later, a message arrived from that skillful and persevering astronomer.
England, Cambridge, December the 6th, to the officers of the Gun Club, Tampa Town, Florida, United States. The projectile discharged by the Columbiad at Tampa Town has been detected, 12th of December at 8:47 p.m., the moon having entered her last quarter. This projectile has not arrived at its destination. It has passed by the side, but sufficiently near to be retained by the lunar attraction. The rectilinear movement has thus become changed into a circular motion of extreme velocity, and it is now pursuing an elliptical orbit round the moon, of which it has become a true satellite. Two hypotheses come here into our consideration. One, either the attraction of the moon will end by drawing them into itself, and the travelers will attain their destination, or two, the projectile, following an immutable law, will continue to gravitate round the moon till the end of time. At some future time, our observations will be able to determine this point. But till then, the experiment of the Gun Club can have no other result than to have provided our solar system with a new star.
When this dispatch was made public, there was a universal feeling of surprise and alarm. Was it possible to go to the aid of these bold travelers? No, for they had placed themselves beyond the pale of humanity. By crossing the limits imposed by the Creator on his earthly creatures. They had air enough for 2 months. They had victuals enough for 12. But after that, there was only one man who would not admit that the situation was desperate, and that was their devoted friend, J.T. Maston.
Those three men have carried into space all the resources of art, science, and industry. With that, one can do anything. You will see. They will come out all right.
Matters seemed very different to the three travelers aboard the Columbiad projectile, staring down at the surface of the moon.
Blast that meteor which crossed our path.
What?
What do you mean?
I mean that our deviation is owed solely to our meeting with that erring body.
That great rock that flew by us soon after we left the atmosphere, but it did not even brush us as we passed.
What does it matter? Its mass compared to that of our projectile was enormous, and its attraction was enough to influence our course.
So little a body?
Yes, Captain Nickel, however little it might be, in a distance of 84,000 leagues it wanted no more than to make us miss the moon. Thus we find ourselves caught up in its gravitational field and pulled into lunar orbit instead of striking the surface of our target.
And well for us, perhaps, that we did not, for the surface, beautiful though it may be, appears from here to be lifeless and airless and highly inhospitable.
Indeed, it appears that it is not inhabited and is probably not inhabitable.
Nonetheless, it also appears that we shall remain in orbit and not fall to the surface, which means, Captain Nickel, that you have won your bet.
Nonsense. The spirit of my bet was that we should not reach the moon. We have not only done so, but gone around the dark side and back. I have lost all three of my bets. Here you are, Mr. Barbicane, $9,000.
You are a gentleman, sir. Will you have a receipt for it?
If you do not mind, it makes things more businesslike.
Not at all. Can you catch my pencils there, sir? I cannot get accustomed to this weightlessness.
Got it. Here you are.
Thank you. And there is your receipt.
Thank you, sir.
Such solemn formality, my friends, as we go sailing round the moon. I have never before seen anything so American. But now that your worldly matters have been settled, come and look out of this port. Here are my opera glasses. Now we've emerged from the dark side and gaze upon the brilliance of the landscape. Tell me, gentlemen, have you ever beheld a finer spectacle?
I have not.
Nor I.
What is that great crater, Mr. Barbicane?
That is Copernicus. According to the great astronomer Tycho, it's the most important of the radiating systems in the southern hemisphere. You see how it forms an almost perfect circle there, and in that part of the Sea of Clouds that borders the Sea of Tempests.
Magnificent. And now, friend Barbicane, I will ask the question which we all seem reluctant to address. What will become of us?
I'll admit to some curiosity on that point as well.
Well, we don't know.
But one can draw some hypotheses, I suppose.
Two, either the projectile speed will be insufficient, and we shall eventually fall to the lunar surface.
I prefer the other hypothesis, whatever it may be.
Or our speed will be sufficient, and we will continue in this elliptical course to gravitate forever around the orb of night.
An alternative not at all consoling. To pass to the state of humble servants to a moon whom we are accustomed to look upon as our own handmaid. So that is the fate in store for us. You do not answer.
There is nothing to answer, my young friend.
Is there nothing to try?
No. Do you pretend to fight against the impossible?
Why not? Do one Frenchman and two Americans shrink from such a word? Ah, well, I do not complain. The trip has pleased me, and the projectile agrees with me. There remains but one thing to do.
What is it?
Breakfast!
Breakfast? By my watch, it's 2 a.m.
Then call it a late supper, if you prefer, Captain. The hour matters little round the moon, wouldn't you say? Besides, I have a glorious bottle drawn from my private cellar. Just let me roll back the rug so that I may raise the storage hatch. Of course, in this weightless state, we shall have to hold our glasses upside down and pour upwards. But when it comes to wine, a Frenchman always finds a way. Mon Dieu, I must admit, we are downright simpletons.
I do not say we are not, but why?
Because we have a very simple means of altering our course from this orbit.
And what is the means?
The recoil contained in our rockets.
By Jove, it is true!
Rockets?
Yes, Captain. The rockets stored right here below the floor, poised to counteract our descent to the surface of the moon, when we thought she might be inhabitable.
They may indeed free us, although once we've used them, we shall have no way to counter our descent back to Earth if we strike land instead of sea.
I should much prefer to fall back to Earth, wherever we strike.
I heartily agree.
Very well. Observe, my friends, the projectile is turning its conical cap toward the moon. When it comes around again and points at the Earth, at that moment we may hope that with the influence of our rockets we may perhaps provoke a homeward course.
Bravo!
17 hours later, according to President Barbicane's calculations, the moment had arrived to detonate the rockets.
All is ready, Michelle. Light the fuse.
The flame has gone down the tube.
Brace yourselves. It'll take a few more seconds for it to reach the rocket hold.
What happened? Have the rockets ignited?
They have, Captain.
I heard nothing.
Indeed not, for there is no air at the base of the rocket pipes, but they have unquestionably ignited, and we are falling.
Toward the Earth?
Yes, at a fall of approximately 160,000 miles at a terminal velocity of approximately 115,200 miles per hour.
And we are lost, after all.
Very well. If we die, the results of our travels will be magnificently spread. The will of heaven be done.
Well said, sir.
Amen.
Many hours later, aboard the Susquehanna, a 500-horsepower corvette of the United States Navy in the Pacific Ocean.
Well, Lieutenant, and our soundings?
I think, Captain Blumsbury, that the operation is nearing its completion. But who would have thought of finding such a depth so near inshore and only 200 miles from the American coast?
Certainly, Bronsfeld, but there is a Great Depression. In this spot, there is a submarine valley worn by Humboldt Current, which skirts the coast of America as far as the Straits of Magellan.
These great depths, I fear, are not favorable for laying telegraphic cables. A level bottom like that supporting the cable between Valencia and Newfoundland is much better.
I agree with you, Bronsfeld. What depth do we have at this point?
3,627 fathoms.
Very well. Kindly take down that result and haul in the sounding line. We shall be ready to start for home as soon as you are finished. It's just after 1 o'clock, Lieutenant, and so... What the deuce is that sound?
Look above there, Captain! That fiery light, getting closer!
Good Lord, Lieutenant, what was that? A rocket? A meteor?
I believe, sir, that was the projectile of the gun club. They are come back from the moon!
Great God! If you're right, they're dead.
They are alive, I'll wager. The water is deep here and will have deadened the shock.
But you saw the projectile was an incandescent mass when it hit the water. They must have burned to death.
Respectfully, sir, dead or alive, what does it matter? We must pull them out.
You are right, young man. Drop a buoy to mark the point where they entered the water. We will return with the necessary equipment.
Soon after, at the headquarters of the gun club in Tampa Town.
And they offer no clue as to its whereabouts.
None whatsoever in this telegram, Mr. Hunter. They only say that the projectile has suddenly disappeared from its orbit around the moon.
Most mysterious.
Mr. Maston, we have just received another telegram.
Another report from the Cambridge Observatory?
No, this one is from the United States Navy.
The Navy? Read it, Mr. Bilsby. Read it at once.
California, San Francisco, December 13, to the Gun Club, Tampa Town, Florida, at 20 degrees 7 north latitude and 41 degrees 37 west longitude, on the 12th of December at 17 minutes past 1 in the morning, the projectile of the Columbiad fell into the Pacific. Send instructions, Blomsberry, Commander Susquehanna.
It has fallen back to Earth. Come, let us make haste to San Francisco, gentlemen.
To do what, Mr. Maston?
Fish up the projectile, of course. The sooner the better.
A week plus several days, which felt to Mr. Maston and his friends like so many centuries, passed before the officers of the gun club were able to arrive at San Francisco. During this time, the Susquehanna was outfitted, with the blessing of the Secretary of the Navy, with every hauling chain, air chamber, and automatic grappling iron known to humankind. As soon as possible, the corvette put to sea again and returned to the spot where they saw the projectile fall.
There's the buoy, Mr. Maston. Shall we begin the search?
Without losing a second, Captain. I am confident that our friends are alive. They are clever people, and they cannot have fallen like simpletons.
Our friend Maston is ever optimistic, Captain.
Too often in the face of reality, I fear.
No, mark my words, gentlemen. They are quite alive, but we must make haste if we wish to find them so. Food and water do not trouble me. They have enough for a long while, but air, air, that is what they shall soon want, so we must work quickly.
Captain! Captain Blomsberry!
Yes, Lieutenant.
Sir, the lookout just spotted an object off the starboard bow.
Let me see. Yes, there it is. I see it. Mr. Maston, may I offer you the use of my spyglass?
Please, sir. Thank you. Ah, treble fools, quadruple idiots, quintuple boobies that we are.
What is it?
Come, speak.
Simpletons to a man. The projectile only weighs 19,250 pounds.
Well?
But it displaces 28 tons, or in other words, 56,000 pounds, and consequently, it floats.
Minutes later, a lifeboat from the Susquehanna, carrying Maston and the gun club officers, came alongside the floating projectile.
Lieutenant Bronsfield, get your men up there and start unscrewing that entry plate.
Aye, aye, sir.
Pardon me, gentlemen.
Mr. Maston, stop!
Come down, sir. You mustn't climb on the projectile.
You'll fall in the water and be drowned.
Forgive me, gentlemen, but I can't wait. I must look through the window.
Well?
What do you see?
I see our friends. Barbicane, Ardan, and Nickel. There they are.
Are they alive?
Are they alive indeed? After we spent these last weeks half mad with worry for them, they are drinking wine and playing at dominoes.
Barbicane, Ardan, Nickel, and the delegates of the gun club, returning without delay to Baltimore, were received with indescribable enthusiasm. And thus ended the story of the first attempt by the people of Earth to leave their globe from the peninsula of Florida and cross the void of space to pay homage to me, the moon, the nocturnal orb, the world's great satellite, the queen of the night. Of course, it's possible I'm a little fuzzy on some of the dates and details, but that, at any rate, is how I recall the story from my vantage point up here, gazing down from the evening sky.
This has been Jules Verne's From the Earth to the Moon, based on the novels From the Earth to the Moon and Round the Moon by Jules Verne, adapted for radio and directed by M.V. Moorhead, produced by Roy Weinberg, executive producer Andrea Pasquale, harp music performed by David Ice. In the cast were David Gofstein, David Ice, Tom Levine, Douglas Loind, Joe Moore, M.V. Moorhead, Daryl Ponish, Richard M. Roberts, Barry Sigwert, and Susan St. John. A Manglefoot production in association with Sun Sounds of Arizona.